Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Big Talk. This is WMPG's weekly conversation show. My name is Suzanne Murphy. I am your host tonight, and I'd like to wish all of the women out there who are listening a happy International Women's Day. Today, March 8th, I think it's the 101st International Women's Day. It's also Women's History Month here in the United States, and here at USM, there have been many events already, and there will continue to be events throughout March and even beyond, because guess what? We need more than 1 month, seriously. Women need more than 1 month. One thing I do want to remind you about is that next Friday, a week from tomorrow, on the 16th, is the gala reception, which celebrates Women's History Month here at USM. It will be held at 4:30 in the Wish Camper Center. And if you want a ticket, it's $15 to the public, $5 for students. Women and Gender Studies Office is your contact person for that. Later that evening at 7, there is a free event also kicking off Women's History Month, and it's a keynote performance instead of a keynote speaker. The performance is a play entitled The Poets and the Assassin. It's playwright Reza Jalali imagines the lives of women in ancient and contemporary Iran, and it is directed by Asunta Kent. That's in Talbot Hall in Luther Bonney, and it is free. So again, that's next Friday, March 16th, big kickoff, although things have already happened. And one thing that's already happened is that this past Tuesday, Nancy Foss, who is a field organizer for the Abortion Access Project, presented a film called The Coat Hanger Project here on the USM campus this past Tuesday, and we have her here with us tonight. So welcome, Nancy, to Big Talk.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. It seemed like a good, a really important thing to do, given the bizarre political climate that women's reproductive rights finds itself in as we speak. With regard to the Abortion Access Project, that is out of Cambridge, Mass?
Yes. The Abortion Access Project is a Cambridge-based organization, and we do work both regionally as well as nationally. And it has an interesting history. It started out as the Reproductive Rights Committee of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, you know, the Our Bodies, Ourselves people.
Mm-hmm.
And they, like many organizations, when they had multi-issues that they were organizing around, they realized that they were competing against each other for funding. So like if the Menopause Committee wanted to solicit philanthropic funding for a conference or an event or an educational opportunity, they would be competing against other people within their own organization, like one's interested in childbirth or abortion or aging, nutrition, fill in any of the blanks.
Women's health in general.
Exactly. So they sort of spun the Reproductive Rights Committee spun themselves off, and then that's what the birth of the Abortion Access Project. And I've been working with them for 12 years now.
And that started in 1992, according to my research.
Yes.
So that's 20 years now.
Yes.
Yep. I forgot to mention that you, the listener, are part of the show. Our phone number is 780-4909. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call. We're here till 8 o'clock. The number again is 780-4909. Well, Nancy Foss, let's talk a little bit about access to abortion. What are the problems here, or what are the issues that you're really focusing on in your group?
Well, a lot of work that I'm focusing on right now is access to abortion in rural areas. A lot of people are familiar with the statistic that roughly 84% of counties in the United States don't have any known providers of abortion care living within them or providing abortions within those counties. So that's a lot of women going about their daily lives with no access to reproductive health care. So in some ways, then you'll find major urban areas where there are a lot of providers of abortion care, all sort of living or working in the same general communities. So in some ways, it isn't even just that there's lots of places where you can't get an abortion, and then there's places where abortions are provided where there's lots of providers. So somehow it's also like a maldistribution of the abortion providers,
mm-hmm.
As well, you know, as the problem of people unwilling to provide in rural areas. So how that plays itself out here in Maine is there are places like Aroostook County or Washington County, for instance, where I'm doing the majority of my work at this time, that there aren't any known public abortion providers in either of those counties, and that makes women that live in those counties have to drive, the closest place would be Bangor. So, for instance, if you live in Fort Kent and the closest place you can go is Bangor, that's a very long ride, one way, 4 to 5 hours, and then you have to turn around and drive back. So that's a long way to go access health care service that is, quite frankly, really pretty straightforward in terms of its how commonly it's performed as well as how safe it is.
And with regard to access, so we have the rural people in general. I mean, rich, poor, whatever. You have to travel a distance. Are there any other aspects of it besides the geographic?
Well, of course, you know, if like any health care, if you don't have health care insurance, that makes it quite a bit a little less able to access it. Because in the same way that rich women or women that live in urban areas are always have greater access to any kind of service, and abortion services wouldn't be any different than that. Whereas if the more poor you are or rural, then it gets increasingly more difficult. But it is, and particularly because really poor women, often if you're eligible for Medicare, Medicaid, that isn't a covered service. Abortion is not covered by Medicaid in this state. Now, there are a lot of states where their Medicaid programs do cover abortion. And it's not because the federal government reimburses them. They don't. It's that the states have made the decision that even though the federal government doesn't reimburse Medicaid for abortion services, that the state does not want to, by virtue of adopting that federal law and not taking on the responsibility of covering it, they don't want women who are obviously already poor. They're already on Medicaid, so they're obviously already poor. They don't want to force women that are already poor to have children that they may not be prepared to parent just because their health insurance doesn't cover abortion. But most private insurance companies do cover abortion.
Once again, we're talking with Nancy Foss from the Abortion Access Project. The film, The Coat Hanger Project, unfortunately, I was unable to get there to see it, but I did go online and watch the trailer. And at the beginning of the trailer, there's a warning that says, sort of a warning that there are going to be images of women who did not have access to safe abortions. And I thought, oh. And then the next thing you see is a really graphic photograph of a naked woman who has bled to death, like on some motel floor. And it is shocking. Can you talk a little bit about the bad old days, the pre-Roe v. Wade days?
Yeah, and that film, The Coat Hanger Project, does do a really nice job of interviewing a couple of women who had abortions before they were legal, as well as showing some pictures of other sort of better known pictures that have turned up well in Our Bodies Ourselves, for instance, is one of the photographs that are in the film. Well, one of the speakers in the movie, her comment was, well, you do what you need to do, no matter how risky it seems or how dangerous it seems. If you are pregnant and you just don't want to be or can't be, then you'll just do what you need to do to not be pregnant anymore. And so the name of the film, The Coat Hanger Project, comes from what was a common way of self-inducing abortion at the time, which was to sort of bend a coat hanger around to the point where you could sort of insert it up into your, through your vagina, up into the opening through the cervix and into the uterus, and you would try to disrupt the pregnancy from your uterus. Now, you start putting a coat hanger into soft tissue, and then you can perforate your uterus and get infections and, bleed out. And there's all sorts of bad things that can happen as a result of trying to self-induce an abortion. But it's also important to remember, too, that before abortion was legal, they weren't all sort of dangerous and in the hands of people that didn't know what they were doing. There were a lot of people who were providers of abortion care who were perfectly trained and knew what they were doing and were willing to take the risk to provide abortions illegally because they had seen plenty of what the results of women trying to induce it themselves. And so there are lots of physicians, and then there are also a lot of lay people, particularly women's groups like the Jane Collective out of Chicago, that taught themselves how to do abortions, provide abortions, and they were, for the most part, very safe.
And for those of you who are listening who may be younger than 30 years or even 40, I don't know. This was 1973 that Roe v. Wade happened. So that period when it was illegal, and then if someone got pregnant and they really just couldn't have that baby, they just didn't They couldn't handle it. They couldn't do it. There were possibly, if you knew somebody who knew somebody, you could find what you're talking about. And then there were the truly desperate women who used the coat hanger.
Yeah.
And some people didn't survive that. And I think for young women, I hope that they understand that that's really what it was like.
Yeah.
That changed things quite a bit.
Well, it's kind of funny. At the beginning of the film, they interview some women in University of Maryland at the beginning of the film, and they ask them, what does a coat hanger have to do with women's health or women's... Mm-hmm. And the response is of nobody... They couldn't find anybody who knew exactly what that symbol meant. And so it was kind of stark, but at the same time a bit amusing, and the comments that people would make. So there is the danger of losing the history of how desperate you can be if you want to have an abortion and you're not able to access it. Because for, 1973, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Women in their 40s generally at this point, they've lived their whole reproductive lives having legal access to abortion care, even if it is having to drive 5 hours or having to work really hard to raise the money, some of those other barriers to access that we talked about, earlier. You can at least sort of get on top of those. You can at least find them not completely insurmountable. But when it's illegal and then more dangerous and so on, it adds another whole layer. One of the things that we've heard people talk about recently is that they think younger women who haven't always had access to abortion or have always had access to a legal abortion, is that people have a little bit more ambivalence, like, oh, why should I fight for it? No one would ever really try to take away my right to have an abortion. And they can just feel a little bit more ambivalent about it being a cause that needs their attention. And one of the things that sort of the old guard, if you will, women that have fought originally for the right, have said that, when you had to go and sneak around and risk your life, literally, to get an abortion, there's not a lot of room for ambivalence in that situation. Whereas, you were gonna put everything you had right into it, and you had really no choice but to do that. You're literally, in many cases, risking your life, and you couldn't be ambivalent if you're gonna risk your life. Whereas now, women just don't have to feel like it's as desperate of a situation where they have to really stay focused on it.
Well, do you think the bizarre political climate that we're in right now during this Republican primary season, when, forget abortion, birth control is now considered controversial by some people, clearly not by the majority of the American people, if you look at any poll it seems to me like maybe it's also a way to raise awareness about not taking certain things for granted. Birth control, seriously?
Yeah.
Dudes.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, really, exactly. Like on the Saturday Night Live skit when they did the whole thing. Really? Really?
Oh, I heard about it.
Seriously? Brilliant. Yeah, it was brilliant. Well, the irony is that that's so spectacularly outrageous, that the minority of people want to try to dictate to what the majority of people just have commonly come to accept as a, basic part of their lives. That is something that gets people riled up. We've had more people responding and wanting to get involved in maintaining their access to reproductive health care services as a result of this extreme and extravagant attack on women's ability to just control their basic bodily functions. That's maybe the irony, is that the result is more people are outraged and active than ever. And for an example, kind of connected to this was, at the same time, there's a big debate in Virginia around forcing women to have transvaginal ultrasounds before they can have an abortion. Now, it doesn't matter that that's not a standard of care. There's no medical reason why you should have to. I mean, we could go on about why you would even try to tell somebody to do that and what the medical reasons are, why it's completely unnecessary. But the political point being, this is something that was being debated in Virginia, that there were already half a dozen states that had pretty much the same exact legislation where it already passed and what have you. But for whatever reason, it was just at the right time that this the discussion around contraception came on board. And all of a sudden, it was just one more thing. People weren't going to let it happen. They were going to get all pissed off about it and make some noise. And they did. And so it really kind of forced, although the bill did ultimately pass in Virginia, it was watered down from what its original language said, as a result of people just getting really annoyed and bringing attention to it.
I just read that today. They did pass it, but it's an abdominal ultrasound, not a transvaginal one.
Yep.
But still, the idea of, like you said, mandating a medical test that is not for medical reasons.
Exactly.
Is weird.
Well, and connected to that, that's just the long line of other restrictions that have been suggested around the country. In some places, they've been enacted. There are states in this country where physicians and nurse practitioners and nurse midwives, whoever's providing abortions, because there are plenty of states where nurse practitioners and nurse midwives and physicians assistants are licensed and regulated to be able to provide abortions. That's not true in Maine, but it's true around lots of places in the country. So I try to not just say doctors, but clinicians in general that provide abortions. There are places where they are mandated to tell a woman before she gets an abortion that it's going to increase her risk of getting breast cancer or becoming depressed or suicidal. Now, it doesn't matter that this is not true and that any reputable medical organization and no peer-reviewed, scientifically sound journal would publish such a claim, American Cancer Society, like just line up the list of people who have refuted these assertions that have been kind of a pet project of folks opposed to abortion. They just try to find sort of the most scary things they can think of, you're going to go crazy and get breast cancer or what have you, and then forcing people to recite that as if it's a fact. And they're legally obligated to do it, even though it's not true. So it's just that's just some of the extremes that we're dealing with around the country.
You're listening to Big Talk. If you're just tuning in, my name is Suzanne Murphy. I'm your host tonight. We're talking with Nancy Foss, who is a field organizer for Northern New England for the Abortion Access Project. And we're talking about, here on International Women's Day and during Women's History Month, we're talking about women's access and to reproductive rights. You can call us at 780-4909 if you'd like to join the conversation, 780-4909. We have about 10 more minutes here. Nancy, I wanted to ask you, in the midst of all of this, is there good news? Is there something you can tell me that's sort of positive about either women's access or some political aspect of it?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the important things to remember is that when you're talking about reproductive health, we are almost always talking about the laws and the regulations that govern the practice of reproductive health. And the irony is, of course, really that it's healthcare and that we should be talking about this from more of a clinical or a medical point of view. And so even though maybe the discourse that surrounds it from a legal or regulatory point of view or a political point of view is sort of all dire and restrictive. From a medical point of view, there's a lot of good news, starting with the fact that we've reached the point about 5 years ago now where the majority of folks entering into medical schools are now women and not men. So it's not much up over 50%, but it is up over 50%. And you can't have all these women going into medical schools and not think that the culture of medicine isn't going to somehow change with it. So women are going to bring their concerns, and their concerns are going to be the things that are close to their life as well, which would include birth control and access to abortion and things like that. So there's been a huge increase in the numbers of medical schools who have chapters of organization called Medical Students for Choice. And part of the work of those organizations on campus is to make sure that in their education and training that they have curriculum that's developed to go over and include women's reproductive health and emergency contraception and all sorts of things related to abortion care and so on. So that all that, because anything that had been historically included, they may have 6 lectures on pregnancy, but nothing on, abortion. So all those chapters have had a great deal of success of changing what's actually being taught in medical schools. And then the same sort of cohort of medical, now physicians, enter their training programs as residents, and they're finding that they're not being exposed to training in those settings for the same similar reasons, mm-hmm. politics, people are afraid, and they go in there and start to demand change in those settings as well. So even just in the last 10 years, 12 years and since I started doing this work for the Abortion Access Project, it's amazing the number of people who have actually been trained to provide abortions, and that's been driven a lot by the numbers of women getting into medicine.
That's interesting, because I remember back, you know, like maybe 20 or 25 years ago, that was a big problem, was that the doctors were coming out with no information on this.
Yeah.
They were, that was just not something that was taught in medical school, which seems kind of weird, because you'd think that there would be times when it wouldn't be necessarily an elective abortion, but a situation where, the woman was in dire straits and in medically and needed to have, and the baby was, you know, the miscarriage was happening, so
yeah,
to speak,
yep,
and you would have to do that type of a procedure.
Right. Well,
so the fact that they weren't taught that just seems really bizarre to me.
Well, there is a lot of, there's a close relationship between some of the other surgical techniques you would be taught mm-hmm. and doing, a first mm-hmm. trimester elective mm-hmm. abortion, and referencing a D&C possibly mm-hmm. after having a miscarriage is certainly one of them. And so if you were an OBGYN resident, for instance, you would certainly, there's no way you're getting out of a residency
right.
program without
okay.
training in that. But then it's not exactly the same thing. And then in terms of its techniques, and it certainly wouldn't be the exact same thing, really, from sort of the provision point of view in terms of making it acceptable for your OBGYN residency program to also offer elective abortions. Not everybody is doing that. But one of the other interesting things, though, is that more and more, as healthcare has continued to change, where abortion provision was primarily for OBGYNs, now there's more and more people in family medicine that are providing abortions mm-hmm. because it is a fairly straightforward, simple procedure from a clinical point of view. And that's even more true now that we have what's known as medication abortion, or people sometimes know as RU486, mm-hmm. the French abortion pill. That's not even a surgical procedure. It's a couple of different medications you take, at certain times, and you can't be further along than 9 weeks in this country to do that. But the vast majority of abortions in this country are already performed before 9 weeks. So essentially, you just need to determine that the pregnancy is, intrauterine, and that makes you eligible for this medication abortion, and you don't even need to engage any surgical instruments at all, which is part of the reason why the technology associated with abortion is so much safer than it used to be. That's mm-hmm. part of the other really good news, is even if abortion was ever made illegal again, and there are states in this country that have trigger laws that if Roe versus Wade was overturned, there's a half a dozen states in this country that immediately the states are already ready to make abortion illegal. So it would be nice to have access.
Yeah, yeah. Again, you're listening to Big Talk. My name is Suzanne Murphy. I'm here tonight with Nancy Foss, who is the field organizer for Northern New England for the Abortion Access Project. And we're talking about women's reproductive rights here on International Women's Day, March 8th. Another issue that I was wondering about was the situation for women in the military. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there was, excuse me.
That's okay.
There was a woman in the film, actually, the Coat Hanger Project, that they documented. She was in the Marine Corps and over in Iraq, and found herself pregnant. And like any other woman in the military, they're not allowed to provide abortions on military hospitals, and their military insurance doesn't cover it.
But they're not even allowed to pay for it themselves. They just can't provide abortions, period, even if the woman says, I'll pay for it myself.
And the irony is I've talked to some other women who were stationed in places, countries where abortion is just considered a routine part of healthcare, like, for instance, in Israel and right across, huge parts of Europe, like women that have been stationed in Germany. So even though they couldn't access the service from their own health insurance. Or on the base. They can just sort of go off base mm-hmm. and access abortion and not even be charged for it, quite frankly, because it's just part of the health service there, which is, of course, not going to be true when you're in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. So it really does put women at great risk to try to figure out what their options are. Mm-hmm. Can they try to get stateside again, or are they going to try to self-induce? And that was the course that the woman in the film chose. She self-induced. And luckily she, you know, was safe and didn't die in the process. She took a big risk to mm-hmm. self-induce an abortion.
So there's still, I'm sure that's gone down radically since the legalization, but there's still women who are self-inducing and dying, or maiming themselves or in some way hurting.
There is self-induction still happening in the United States, but they're less likely to be using surgical instruments now and more likely being able to use medication that is available. You need a prescription mm-hmm. for it in this country, but there are countries around the world where it's actually available over the counter. And women, that's part of the reason why the maternal morbidity and mortality rates in Central and South America, where abortion is still mostly illegal, women aren't dying at the same rates that they used to be because no one really needs to stick a coat hanger in their uterus anymore when they know they can go down to the pharmacy and get these medications that are available over the counter. And as long as they, you know, insert them into their vagina at the right time where they're not too far along and what have you, they have what looks essentially like a spontaneous miscarriage, and no one ever really needs to know about it. So the technology is much better. It's a lot safer than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we're almost out of time here, but we appreciate you coming in tonight, Nancy. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Yes.
You're welcome.
And I'd like to remind everybody, we've been talking tonight with Nancy Foss, and we have gone over all the access issues of, well, not all, maybe, but we've tried to cover the access issues for abortion in this country. This is Women's History Month, and I just want to remind everybody again about the gala reception on Friday, March 16th, here at the Wish Camper Center at 4:30, and then at 7 o'clock, the keynote performance of the play about women in Iran. So please, if you have any questions about that, contact the Women and Gender Studies office here at USM. You can find them online at the USM website. Thank you very much, Nancy. Any parting words? Do you have anything to say to all the women out there on International Women's Day?
Don't be afraid. Be ready.
I like it. I like it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Please stay tuned for Cinema Hits and Misses, and after that, Jazz with Justine. This is Suzanne Murphy. Good night.